So we're really fortunate this morning to have Frank Coonerly, the Pirates president, on hand to welcome everyone and to talk a little bit about everything that's going on with the Pirates. Frank, as I mentioned, he's president of the Pirates, where he's responsible for day-to-day operations of the team. Prior to joining the Pirates in 2007, he served for nearly a decade in the commissioner's office as senior vice president and general counsel of labor. And now let me introduce Frank Coonerly.
Thank you very much, Mark. Good morning. Welcome to the beautiful city of Pittsburgh. It doesn't always rain 4 inches within a couple of hours here, okay? So if you experienced that last night, and particularly if you experienced that at the beautiful PNC Park, my apologies. I am, as I've learned over my now 10-plus years at the Pirates, I'm in charge of some things, I'm not in charge of other things, and I'm certainly not in charge of the weather. But I do like statistics, and I know you do as well. And because we had a very, very poor OPS, slug, ISO, with our last weather forecasting group over a period of 10 years that I was here, I finally broke down this offseason and made a change with our forecasters. I'm not naming any names on either side of the ledger. So we made a change after 10 years of general dissatisfaction. Our new forecasters are now 0-2. That's not a very good batting average, on base percentage, or any of the like. Thank you very much. They will appreciate your support. The young lady said there's a small sample size so far, so we'll give them some additional leeway and hope that they improve. But just to tell you, and I was really upset last night as they were telling us this was going to run south of PNC Park. We were going to be fine. They were wrong. It hit us. And then they told us, okay, now it's really going south. This next cell is really going south of PNC Park. You will be fine to play at 8:45. And, of course, if you were there, we took the tarp off. We were all ready to go at 8:45, and we got an urgent call. No, this cell has moved more northerly than we thought it would, and it's going to hit you as well. And then it did for another about 2.5 inches of rain at PNC Park, completely flooding both dugouts. So I was really upset. But when I drove home, I got about, and I only live 12, 13 miles north of the city, but as I got about halfway home last night, the torrential rain ended, and my wife reported we didn't get anything where I lived. So there really was a fine line, and unfortunately PNC Park was on the wrong side of that line. I hope that you will have an opportunity, if you were there last night or not, to come and visit us at PNC Park. I know that some of the sessions on Friday move over to the ballpark. You'll have an opportunity not only to see one of the truly iconic ballparks in America, but to hear from some of our people at the Pirates who are, in general, much more interesting than me and really drive the baseball side of the Pittsburgh Pirates, as you'll hear from our general manager, Neil Huntington, and the head of our analytics department, Dan Fox, among others. And then I hope you're able to stay for the game that night, and if you can come and join us tonight. The forecast for the weekend is not particularly good. They're hedging their bets now, but the forecast for tonight is supposed to be very good. So I think that we'll be in good shape tonight. So I'm thrilled that you're here in Pittsburgh. We have, obviously, as you know better than I, we have a long and very rich history with the great game of baseball here in Pittsburgh, both playing the game at all of the various amateur levels and then also being, of course, the home to one of the truly iconic franchises in our sport, the Pittsburgh Pirates. I don't want to get in any debates here. We say that we started in 1887. I was yelled at by some people who said that we started in 1882. I researched that, as you would expect somebody to research that. I was informed that Elias Sports says 1887 because the American Association, where we played in 1882 to 1887, wasn't a major league. I've had other people tell me it was a major league. So we're either 1882 or 1887. Either way, it's a long time that baseball has been played right here at in Pittsburgh. And for most of the time, very close to where we are playing. Well, no, I take that back. For much of the time, very close to where we play at PNC Park. Other than the very long tenure of Forbes Field, Pirates baseball was played on the north side or north shore of Pittsburgh. And now we're very fortunate to have it played in what, in my humble opinion, is the best ballpark in all of Major League Baseball. So I hope that you enjoy it. I hope that you get an opportunity, dodging raindrops, to enjoy the beauty of this city. It is spectacular, and those of you who have never been here before are probably already surprised because, you know, Pittsburgh has a reputation as a steel city, which is well earned. It doesn't necessarily have a reputation of one of the most beautiful cities in America, which it should have, and it certainly is. So I hope that you enjoy not only the Pirates game, obviously all of the work that you're doing here in this conference, but get an opportunity to enjoy many of the wonders of the city of Pittsburgh. Let me turn now to what you do here, and I know for most of you it's not a job, but it's a passion, it's a calling, and it's what you love. What you do is really important for the game of baseball. You preserve the history of the game. You make sure that the telling of the history is passed down from generation to generation. You reveal some history that either we didn't know or we might have forgotten over the years. And that's an important part of the generational aspect of the great game of baseball. We are America's pastime for a very simple reason, because we love the game and we insist that we pass it down from generation to generation. And as a result, nothing makes me happier than when I'm at the ballpark and I see several generations of a family at PNC Park enjoying baseball, enjoying the Pirates, and teaching our children about the great game of baseball. So I'll touch on youth participation in the game a little bit later, but what you do is important to preserving this great game. What you do is also important because, unlike some of the people that still use pen and paper or ink or digital typing, you base your writings on facts, data, and vigorous research. Not everything that you read, whether it be in politics or in sports today, is based on facts, research, and data. I've noticed that. Some of the writings about the Pittsburgh Pirates have not been based on facts, research, and data. But you insist that your writing and your communication with us as you deliver either the history, the statistics, the analytics of this great game be based on all of that rigorous work that used to be the foundation for all of our writing in the press. It no longer is, unfortunately. But it does preserve here, and we appreciate that. As you know, again, better than I, no sport, in America at least, has a richer or deeper history than baseball. And part of the reason why we know that is because of the terrific work that is done by the men and women of Sabre. In Pittsburgh, we're also lucky that not only do we have an iconic baseball team, we also have some other great sports teams as well. One of the best, if not the best, stadium in all of baseball, a beautiful city that I've already described, but we have the best Sabre chapter in all of America, led by George Scornickel. And I have really gotten, thank you. I know some of you from some other cities might disagree, but we're in Pittsburgh today. And in all seriousness, the local Pittsburgh chapter of Sabre is wonderful. I've gotten to know George, his predecessor, Bob Sproul. Before that, the leaders of Sabre here, they work extremely hard on the history of the game, the statistical comings and goings of the game, and also the Pittsburgh Pirates. And I was thrilled to see that many of the papers and presentations today deal with some of the greats of the Pittsburgh Pirates. And that's because of the fine work of the Forbes Field chapter of Sabre here in Pittsburgh that does terrific work. So we have a lot of history with the Pirates. Whether it's 82 or 87, there are great teams, including that 1902 team that was born just 1 year too early. 1 year before we decided that we were going to play that World Series, perhaps, now again, I'm biased, but perhaps the greatest baseball team ever to be fielded by a major league club was fielded right here in Pittsburgh in 1902. Look it up if you don't believe it. They were born 1 year too early. And the 1903 team didn't quite get the job done. Also, we have been blessed in Pittsburgh to be the home, and the Pirates to be the home, of some of the most iconic players to have ever played the game. And you will have some presentations, and you have over the years, you'll have more presentations today on some of the iconic Pirates players, including the great one, Roberto Clemente. So as you continue to learn about and to teach us about the great sport of baseball and the great Pirates like Clemente or Hank Greenberg, who was here for only a year, or Ralph Kiner, who had some maybe an unhappy ending here as he left, and maybe some tension between he and Branch Rickey, which I look forward to reading that presentation. Not only some of the greatest players to ever play the game have played here in Pittsburgh, but the great one is known for so much more than baseball, and I'm sure that you've read and heard and you will read and hear about his humanitarian efforts, not only the one that led to his death, bringing those supplies to Nicaraguan people who had suffered the earthquake, but on a day-to-day basis, the way the man led his life to improve the lives of others. So the legacy of the great one, Roberto Clemente, I will tell you, drives the Pittsburgh Pirates on a daily basis, on the field and off the field. So this past year, when Maria struck the beautiful island of Puerto Rico like never before, and devastated the island, taking down most of the power grid, destroying many of the homes that people had built, the Pittsburgh Pirates acted in the legacy of the great one, Roberto Clemente, really driven by ideas of our players. And many of our players from Latin heritage came to us and said, we need to do something for the people of Puerto Rico last September, as we were all reading about the devastation of Maria. And they said, and we need to do something more than simply write a check. Anybody can write a check. We need to live the legacy of Roberto Clemente. We need to collect supplies here in Pittsburgh, where people remember what Roberto Clemente stands for. We need to collect supplies, and we need to personally take those supplies to the people of Puerto Rico, particularly the people in the outskirts outside of San Juan, who are not getting the relief efforts that were first hitting the island. And so I was thrilled to hear that. As they laid out the plan, it all made a lot of sense, and they said, but Frank, we only need you to do one thing. We need you to get a big airplane so we can fly those supplies to Puerto Rico. I said, okay, but I don't have a big airplane. But fortunately, we have good friends at FedEx. And FedEx here in Pittsburgh is the home to FedEx Ground, and they do have big airplanes. So I picked up the phone, and I talked to FedEx, and I said, we need a big airplane. And they said, our biggest is the MD-11. You have it. And I then said, I was nervous because we had already announced, or we were getting ready to announce, that we were going to start a two-day collection the next day. This was on a Sunday in September. Some people were interested in football at the time. Not everybody was interested in the end of the Pirates season at the time. I was, but not everybody was. And this was a Sunday. We hadn't yet gotten the big plane. But now that we got the big plane, we were going to start this drive Monday and Tuesday. The team was still home. The players wanted to be there for the supply drive. And now we had to announce it, promote it, and get people to respond to it. I asked them, how much does this big plane carry in terms of pounds? He said about 170,000 pounds. That sounded like a lot to me, but I'm not in logistics. I said, you know, in terms of tractor trailers full of supplies, food, medicine, clothing, baby formula, roughly what's 170,000 pounds in tractor trailers? And he said, anywhere from 10 to 12. Now I'm nervous because I don't think there's any chance in the world that in 2 days with very short notice, we're going to be able to collect enough for 12 tractor trailers full of supplies to send to Puerto Rico. And the last thing I want to do is make a commitment that we're going to help and make a difference in the lives of the people of Puerto Rico and send a half full plane there. So we got out all of our communication efforts. Well, the long story short is it wasn't necessary because the people of Pittsburgh do remember the great legacy of Roberto Clemente and responded as only the generous people of Pittsburgh could. And over the 2 days, particularly after people saw on TV what was taking place the first day, the second day, we quadrupled what we collected, and we ended up with 450,000 pounds of food, clothing, and medicine for the people of Puerto Rico. And I then needed to get another big plane, which we did, thankfully. Thank you. Only in Pittsburgh and following, only because of the legacy of Roberto Clemente, in my judgment, was that possible. Let me turn to a topic that I know is a topic of some of the presentations here, and that is the way that our game is currently being played, how it's evolved over the years. Perhaps some of the reasons that it's evolved in that way, and then at least throwing out a few ideas as to do we want to make any changes in the rules of the game that will change the way the game has evolved. Now, I could be stoned for saying that in this room. I understand that. The game of baseball, in my judgment, as well, so you're not alone. In my judgment, one of the greatest things about the game of baseball is that, in essence, it's been played the same way for 100-some years. That's unbelievable. There are rules changes in football. I can't understand any of them, by the way, but there are rules changes in football every year, sometimes during the year. They like to make changes in their rules to tweak and turn. We really haven't had any major rules changes in the way the game has been played on the field since 1969 when the mound was lowered and 1972 when we introduced a designated hitter in one league. Kind of crazy to have two separate rules in two leagues. I think we're all coming to that conclusion after 40 years or so. I'd rather play the National League game myself. Others would rather play the American League game. We probably should play the same game, but we're not going to solve that debate here today. But the game has not changed, and while players have changed, the game has evolved, to be sure. The size of the players, the strength of the players, all those things have been changed over the years. When you hit a ground ball to shortstop, somehow the shortstop still gets that runner by a half a step. I don't know how it happens. It has not changed. Now, the game is also a game of adjustment. And we've adjusted over the years. We've evolved over the years. The players have evolved. The use of analytics has certainly changed the way we are training our players to play the game. Will there be adjustments that make rules changes unnecessary? I think we should already be there by now. I can't tell you how frustrated I am when our team has a wide open left side of the infield and insists on hitting into that darn shift, particularly when we're down by 5 runs and we need base runners. I don't get it. So in my view, and not everybody in Major League Baseball agrees with me, I'm not a fan of the outlawing defensive shifts. I don't know. So some agree, some disagree. There is a movement in baseball that we should outlaw defensive shifts. I'm not sure how you can do it. You know, you can tell two infielders you have to stay on the left side of the bag at second base, and two, you have to stay on the right side at least until the pitcher throws the ball. Then what's the definition of the pitcher throwing the ball? Is it when he starts his windup? Is it when he releases the ball? Are we going to ask umpires to keep their eye, one eye on players who are standing right at second base, running over to the left side of the infield or the right? I don't know. In my judgment, you know, the NFL, which makes rules changes all the time, as I said, they don't tell the safeties which side of the field to stand on. If you think you can be more effective standing on the left side and covering the people over there, go for it. But we're not going to solve that debate tonight or today either. But I do think that a couple of things are undeniable, and that is the way the game is being played on the field today is much different than it was played when I was growing up in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. Much different. Now, is it good or bad? I'm not sure. Some people may like it more. Some people may not. But for sure, the things that are taking place, and whether any of this is related to what's going on in attendance, is another matter, something that we're looking at very carefully at Major League Baseball. Obviously, people are concerned anytime you see a downturn league-wide in attendance, and you need to figure out through data and through surveying why that is so. Does it have to do with the way the game has evolved to being played? We're not certain, but we are looking at that among many, many other issues that may be attributable to why attendance over the last couple of years, and this year in particular, has declined some. In terms of how the game is being played, there's been a lot of ink spilled on time of game, pace of game. There have been a couple of things that we have done recently that have helped in that regard. There are things that we can and I think we should have done, we have done, and the good news is they have been largely successful. So the new rule this past year, limiting the number of mound visits, I was a strong supporter of. When a rookie catcher in Chicago, who won't be named, in the first week that he's in the big leagues, is making 12 trips to go tell John Lester what to throw, I'm out. I'm out on that. I thought that was ridiculous, and the game is being played. Pitchers know what to throw. They have scouting reports before the game. They can figure out what to throw the pinch hitter that comes up in the eighth inning. We don't need to go to the mound 20 times. So we have actually cut the average number of mound visits from 2017 of around 8 to this year under 4. That's cut almost a minute off the game. So that's a structural change in my view that made sense, worked. We didn't have these type of mound visits back in the day, trust me. Also, we made some changes in terms of the between inning breaks, and we cut over a minute off of the game by speeding up the time between innings without taking away any of the commercials. That's worked. But the game takes longer today for a number of reasons. One of them is we are seeing more pitches, and we have trained our hitters to see more pitches. There's no question about that. We have trained, and this isn't just something that happened yesterday, we have trained our hitters to be much more patient at the plate, and they are. Very rarely is that ball put in play in the first or second pitch. When Major League Baseball did a presentation on the pace of play several years ago, interestingly, since we're here in Pittsburgh, they started the presentation. They had MLB Network do a great piece, a research piece. They started the presentation by showing a number of the clips and the statistics from the Game 7 of the 1960 World Series when the Pirates beat the Yankees 10-9 in a fascinating game. There was not a single strikeout in that game, and the ball was put into play in the first or second pitch over 40% of the time. Not a single strikeout, balls put into play in the first or second pitch over 40% of the time. Today, first or second pitch, I think the number is 14%. Whole different game. A 10-9 game, what would that take today? I don't know. 3.5, 4 hours? If we're lucky? George, 2 hours and 32 minutes, something like that. 2 hours and 32 minutes. I know, fewer commercial breaks and all that, but the game has changed the way we've played it, and part of it is because we've trained our players to play the game a certain way. Another one, and I can blame this on you, you started this analytical revolution, and now you've taught all these smart people in front offices that pitchers are not as effective the third and fourth time through the lineup, so we bring more in. And every team has taken the number of position players on the bench down, 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 and added more relief pitchers. And had we done the change, the swap that we had proposed to the union in the last collective bargaining agreement, thank goodness we didn't, and that is in order to get relief from the 40 players who can be active for the game in September also, you know, a whole different game is played in September, which is unusual. Most other sports don't do that. So in order to gain relief in collective bargaining from the 40 active players that can be available to these very bright managers in September and bring that down to, say, 30, also different, but 30, there was a proposal that will go to 26 during the other 5 months of the year. Ultimately, the union rejected it. To me, I'm very fortunate. I'm glad because if we had another player for 5 months of the year, you know who he would be. It would be another reliever throwing left or right, and the managers would be bringing them in constantly. So we have more pitchers. We have more pitching changes. We bring in more pitchers. It all takes time. And these additional pitchers also particularly throw very hard and are difficult to hit. So the game has changed. I think, and we don't know all the reasons for that, but the way we train our players even before they get in professional organizations has changed. So to me, a couple of the stunning statistics that I'll share with you are, and this will not surprise any of you, the three true outcomes of our game, strikeout, walk, and home run, have increased in each of the last 8 to 10 years. And we are now at historic highs. In the 1980s, strikeout, walk, or home run, three true outcomes, 23% in the decade of the 80s. Today, 34% of the time, you have one of the three true outcomes. You know, some people like home runs. We liked them back when the Babe introduced them to the game at a prodigious rate. If you watch SportsCenter or MLB Network, you see a lot of home runs being hit. I think people like them. I'm not sure how much we like walks. They're part of the game. I know that people in front offices, when there are walks, we like them. I'm not sure how much the fans like them, particularly if it doesn't result in running around the bases and stolen bases. Strikeouts, we like them when our pitcher, we love them when Nolan Ryan was striking out people at prodigious rates. But the long and short of it is there is now much more time in the game, 3 minutes and 41 seconds between any action, the ball being put into play. And by put into play, I'll even include a home run. And that's gone up each of the last 10 years as well. So a number of reasons for it, but the way the game is now played on the field is much different than it was back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and I'm sure even much longer before that. And whether that's a good or bad thing, we can debate, and we are debating, but there can't be any debate that it has changed the way the game is presented. Also, obviously, we never had instant replay before. That adds some time to the game. That's something that we've actually helped ourselves in over the last couple of years by some rules changes there. Now managers have to say they're challenging. We're not challenging within 30 seconds. And the replay in New York, once it gets to them, needs to be concluded within 2 minutes. But because of those changes, We've moved the average time per challenge from the time that the manager decides to challenge from 151 to two, or from 228 to 151 this past year. So some of those structural changes that we can change, we have, but the way the game has been changed, the way the game is played on the field has overcome many of those and has increased the time of game. And put aside the time of game, it's just the way the game is being played. So I think I'm on the competition committee, and I know we're taking seriously these issues. Not only are we trying to find causal relationships between them and the way that our fans consume the game, but we're stepping back and asking ourselves, what do we, as the people that are invested in baseball, and more importantly, what do you, what do our fans of the game, what do you want to see? How do you want to consume the game? And then that brings you to some, you know, very, very difficult decisions as to how fundamental, if we decide that we want to get the game back to where it was, pick your favorite decade, and it normally is when you're about ages 7 to 16. That's my favorite decade. And part of the reason for that is because once I got to 16, I wasn't very good at baseball anymore, darn it. And that was a realization for me. But pick your favorite decade or your favorite time as a fan. That's the way you'd like to see the game being played. I know a lot of people love the game when there's more hits in the field, not all the hits being home runs, more hits in the field, more running, more action in the field, more stolen bases, more first to third, more first to home, action on the field. And then what changes, if anything, to the fundamental rules of the game, if we conclude that's where we want to be, what fundamental changes to the rules of the game do we want to implement, and who and how many people will we offend if we make what in some people's view will be viewed as very fundamental and damaging changes to the way our game has always been played. I didn't think it was all that, and I'm a traditionalist. I think, you know, when I went on to the competition committee, I think they put me on because they thought I was one of the new guard and I could think progressively, and every rules change that they came up with and suggested, I said, no, you can't change the game that way. It's the beauty of our game. You can't change. So I'm not sure the commissioner is thrilled that he put me on the committee. So I'm a traditionalist. I didn't think that it was all that stunning or revolutionary or really changed the spirit of the game when we said that an intentional walk, we can just put up four fingers. But trust me, I got a lot of mail that suggested that we had just done irreparable damage to the game. So we are a sport, as I said at the outset, that we haven't made many fundamental changes to the rules of the game. The game has evolved the way it's been played, but not because of our intervention. And anytime we propose to intervene in that way, we hear from people that don't appreciate that. And I understand that and appreciate it because our game has been the most beautiful game, in my view, for all of these decades because of the way that players adjust to the game. And so let's just go, you know, the shifts for 1 second. And those of you who analyze these things will know this. I'm not a big fan of the shift, outlawing the shift, as I mentioned. And I start with the proposition that if the shifts were causing problems that we see in the game, and that is not enough action, you should see it in a massive change in the batting average of balls hit in play. Anybody know what batting average and balls hit in play has done over the last 3 decades? Yes, sir. Gone nowhere. Absolutely. Much higher today than it was in the go-go 80s, as a matter of fact. I look at that. Look, I'm not a statistician. I used to pretend that I was when I would do salary arbitration cases, but I'm not a statistician. But if these shifts are not causing a change in BABIP, what are we solving for here? Well, players now, because you're putting them in a shift on them, are training themselves to hit the ball out of the ballpark. I'm like, really? That's why they're doing it? Not because they get paid $30 million if they hit 40 bombs? So there's some, we all have strong opinions on these things because we love the game. Some of us have different opinions, but the fact is Babbitt hasn't changed, if anything, from the go-go 80s that I loved, I think many of us love, Babbitt is much higher today. The problem is we're striking out way too much, and a much larger percentage of our Babbitt today are balls that go over the fence. We like it or we don't like it. So those are really, really big issues that are facing the game, and I think I'll go back to what I started with, and that the work that you do is incredibly important because you hold us to a higher standard, not only in terms of being true to the fabric and the history of this game, but being true to making decisions based on real live data, as opposed to supposition, rumor, speculation, I think so. And that's important. Let me touch on another topic that is very important to us, and that is preserving the game of baseball and passing it down to the generations. We all know that, and the commissioner was very strong on this when he first took office. We know from research and data that the number one indicia of whether or not you will be a fan, and particularly an avid fan of the game of baseball, is did you play as a youth, baseball, softball? Did you play the game? And if you did, you are much, much more likely to love the game, to follow the game, to consume the game in the various ways that we would like you to consume the game. And we also knew that along with all of the other participation, team participation sports, the participation in baseball was going down and had been for quite a while for a variety of reasons, I'm sure. Unfortunately, the activity that was going up while baseball, football, basketball, and hockey even, which was growing, were all going down, was doing nothing. Inactivity was rising, and activity in team sports were going down across the board. So the commissioner made it one of his top priorities to make sure that we're doing everything we can to have kids playing the game of baseball again and get that number growing, getting more kids. And that's a complicated topic, one that in my remaining minutes here I can't solve, and I know I can't. I know that the commissioner is working on it very hard, and he's charged each and every one of us in the local markets to do so. And the initial numbers are helpful, at least, are encouraging. Now, these numbers I don't think are as rigorous as yours, so I don't want to overread them because there's a lot of work to be done. But over the last 2 years, the percentage of kids playing baseball in an organized fashion has actually gone up. I know that I just read an article the other day that made some derogatory comments about my general manager and also said the real issue with attendance is youth participation in baseball is going down. The fact of the matter is it increased by 6% last year, which was a greater percentage than any other team sport in the United States, according to Sports Fitness Industry Association. They're the ones that chronicle this. Since the commissioner instituted the Play Ball Initiative and charged each of us to make sure that we're breaking down whatever barriers are keeping kids from playing baseball in our local markets has gone up by 12% over the last 3.5 years. So there is encouraging news in that on that front, and that is important that we make sure that we do everything in our power to make baseball fun for kids. And being a father of four kids myself, I know one of our greatest challenges, you know, there are some economic challenges that Pirates and Pirates Charities are working hard to make sure they're not keeping. Economic, financial issues are not keeping kids from playing this great game. That should not be and cannot be the case. There are other issues that have nothing to do with finances or economics. Baseball is an individualized sport, and it's hard to play. It's hard to play, particularly at a young age. That may be our greatest challenge. We need to continue to work to find ways to make the essence of the game, throwing, hitting, running, catching, fun for kids when they're 4 and 5 years old. So So as a father myself, my kids and I had three girls and then a boy, my girls all played soccer. I can tell you, we took them out as 4 and 5 year olds. They ran up and down the field. They hit the ball a couple times. They felt good about themselves. They thought they were great. They loved the game. You put a 4-year-old out at shortstop, put aside the picking dandelions in right field. You put a 4-year-old outside of shortstop. You give them a hard Major League Baseball. You get an overly zealous coach whacking ground balls to that 4-year-old at shortstop. One, the ball goes through his legs. He doesn't feel good about himself. He doesn't think that he's a good player. And you might tell him, we've started the travel team of 4-year-olds and you're not on the team. Sorry, your three friends that you think are your buddies, they're on the team because they're great baseball players. They're going to be major league players. You're not on the team. That's a whole nother problem. But baseball's a hard game. And when I let that ball go through my legs as a 4-year-old, I know I failed. Put aside being on the mound, I saw my son melt down when all of a sudden as an 8-year-old, who was a pretty good pitcher, he can't find a strike zone. He's hitting kids. Now, fortunately for the other team, they had a rule that you hit 2 kids in one inning, you had to take the pitcher out. So he came out after that on that rule many times. But it's a very individualized game, and it's a lot harder to build practices and to build drills to make you feel good about yourself when you walk off the field and you get in your mom and dad's car to go home. I had a great time playing baseball. I love this. So we have a lot of issues. We know that they're critical to our sport. They're critical to making sure that we follow the legacy of my mom and dad, and that is pass the game on to our children. We need to make it fun for the kids to play the game. And, you know, if we had 20 more hours, we could get into the travel baseball and the travel sports and all that craziness and the year-round. My son dealt with it. My son was a decent baseball player, decent hockey player, and more than decent soccer player. And he played all of them at a travel level from the time that they started playing travel sports at various sports, 9 years old, whatever it was. But by 13, he had to quit 2 of them because every single coach needed you, not needed you, you had to be there or you weren't on the team. It wasn't a question of, you know, coach, I'd really like to play these other sports. And no, if we travel every weekend for hockey, and if you're not here, you're not on the team. Well, the soccer coach said, well, we play every weekend, and if you're not here, you're not on the team. So we have a lot of issues that we need to figure out how to solve. I know from the Pirates' perspective, we love multi-sport athletes. And matter of fact, we're still finding them. So they're still out there. We love them. And among the many reasons that we love multi-sport athletes when we're looking at kids in the draft is a real simple one here. And that if, you know, if we're looking at you in the draft, you're a very good baseball player. You know what? You might be the 6th man on your basketball team, and you're learning a lot about what it means to be a teammate as a 6th man on your basketball team that you probably haven't learned by being the star shortstop, number 4 hitter, and star pitcher on the baseball team. And those are valuable lessons that you're learning as a 6th man on the basketball team that serve you well when you are not the star pitcher, shortstop, and cleanup hitter on the Pittsburgh Pirates in 5 years. So those are important issues. I think I'm going to end it there because I've covered quite a bit, hopefully kept you awake this morning. I do want to, in the remaining time that I have here, which looks to be about 5 to 7 minutes, unless Mark tells me otherwise, open it up for any questions that you might have. Because I have found that typically crowds like me to address issues that are important to them rather than the issues that are important to me. Yes, sir. My eyes aren't very good, so I can't see your name tags. But
what are the Pirates doing to get Major League Baseball to retire number 21?
That's a great question. We obviously live the legacy of Roberto Clemente. We support the retire 21 movement. It hasn't picked up steam within Major League Baseball. We've let them know that we support the movement. And I really would rather not speak for the commissioner or anybody at Major League Baseball as to where they are on the topic. I know that obviously there is one number retired throughout all of baseball, number 42. There is a strong movement that 21 should be the next. I've heard from others who take the other view that I would rather 21 only to be retired here in Pittsburgh, where the great Roberto Clemente played his entire career. It should only be retired here. And that way it allows others to honor the great Clemente by wearing 21 on other teams. I get that position as well. We've supported it. I don't know where Major League Baseball is. Yes, sir.
Let me take one
over here first, and then I'll come back. Thank you.
I read an article in, I think, the Athletic, I think somebody discussed, there was a professor at Ball State. They asked him what he would do to help the game out. And he came up with two ideas. Lowering the mound another 5 inches, because obviously it would obviously change the movement of the ball and all that. And the second was, it's very controversial, he called it a dynamic strike zone, meaning that the first pitch that you throw, it's a very small zone, and as you got further and further along in the at-bat, it would get larger and larger. Now, I don't know if the umpire, this is serious. Well, I'm just saying.
No. There are a lot of good ideas. There's some that, you know, some people view as crazy. I think the second one, let me take the second one. That one seems to me to run counter to what we want to do, what personally I want to do. I want to see the ball put in play more quickly. And if you have a tiny strike zone, you're never going to swing at the first pitch.
But no, the pitcher would know to have to throw the ball there, and the batter would know it would be the best pitch he would get all at bat.
I hear you. if you put a strike zone right in the sweet spot, I get it. I think you're more likely to have balls being thrown, and we're going to watch them. On the first one, that's one of the proposals that we have considered, the lowering the mound further. And as you might imagine, that is one where we first have to make sure that from a biomechanical perspective, we don't increase the risk of injury, because that's the last thing that we can do. So that is being studied. I don't believe we're going to conclude that lowering the mound further will increase injuries. It might actually help reduce injuries. If it does, that's one that I would certainly look to consider for one reason, among other reasons, because there is some history there, right? Raising, lowering the mound has not been static. It's our entire existence. There's some history. Some of the games on the sand lots are played on flat mounds, so it's not as if we have no experience with that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Richard Tarangio, Boston chapter and Southern Rhode Island chapter.
Welcome.
Thank you. I want to thank you for coming today with a nice presentation about baseball to our group.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I was at the game on Tuesday for that beautiful evening, and I was at the game last night for not so much beautiful evening. I don't know if you have any say in this, but around the conference table, there is not enough salad in these salad containers for $11.
Okay, I do have a say in that.
And as a connoisseur of shakes, there is not enough shake. There might be enough shake for $8, but there is certainly not enough shake for $10.
All right, thank you. Did you go to BRGR, that milkshake
yes.
there?
Yes. Okay. Section 115.
Right. Okay.
The shake was excellent. There just wasn't enough of it.
I got it. All right. Got both of those. Not enough shake. Yes, sir.
Question in connection with your scouting internationally. I think you've signed players from South Asia in the last 10 years or so. I think a couple of pitchers. You've signed at least an infielder from South Africa. Are you still scouring the world for talent?
Yes, we better. We better be better than our competitors in the domestic draft and internationally. The Pirates, the great Pirates teams, now there were different rules. There weren't aggregate salary caps or aggregate signing caps internationally. There wasn't, I take that back. There weren't restrictions on signing players, but the great teams of the 70s were built here in Pittsburgh in large part, not entirely, but in large part on a very aggressive and state-of-the-art international scouting operation in Pittsburgh. We needed to get back there. I think we've made some progress. We're not where we need to be, however. We do also have, now he just went back down to the minors, the first Lithuanian-born and raised pitcher as well. So we're looking for talent all over the globe, and we need to make sure that we're beating the other teams there. Yes, sir.
Very brief two-part question. One, how often is the team using the pillbox caps at this point? And two, however often that is, can you have them do it more?
It is a great look. We are currently all home Sundays wearing our 1979 uniform that Joe has on here, except for the pillbox cap, but the gold jersey, black pants, and the black pillbox cap every Sunday. Yes, sir.
On the subject of that gentleman follow-up on the strike zone, being on the competition committee, can you give any insight on whether Major League Baseball is going to bring technology into calling balls and strikes? Because with all due respect to umpires, I know that's a tough job, but they just seem to be so inconsistent. And I'm just wondering if you've seen anything on that.
Great question. And one that I will tell you, being on the competition committee, one that we are not currently considering today, but one that I'm certain we or our successors will consider. I was always anytime people would ask me, do you ever see us getting to that computer-generated strike zone as calling balls and strikes? And I said, for years, no, we'll never get that. This is baseball. We have umpires. We need to have umpires. I'm moving from that. And, you know, maybe it's just the reason is we are, and this is the same reason that instant replay came in, and as usual, my wife was way ahead of me on this topic. Before we had instant replay, my wife would get so frustrated watching the game because, of course, the broadcasters have super slow-mo instant replay, and they show that the umpire has made the wrong decision. Now, she only cared when they made the wrong decision to the detriment of the Pirates, like me, so she's right-minded, but she would get frustrated. She goes, you're showing me that the umpire got it wrong. Why don't you let the umpire look at that? Well, you know, that's the broadcaster. Well, okay, if you think baseball is beautiful, you've been umpired by humans all these years, you don't want to allow calls, wrong, incorrect calls to be changed by replay, don't show the replay because you're frustrating me. Well, you don't understand. We don't control the broadcaster. They're enhancing the entertainment. They're going to show it. Well, if you show it, you have to allow the people on the field who are charged with making the right calls have it. That's where we got instant replay. I think we're getting there with the box as well. The box isn't perfect. I do know that, and the umpires will remind me of that. The box isn't perfect yet, but the box will be perfect. And what we are asking the home plate umpire to do, in my judgment, is becoming increasingly difficult. More players are throwing with high velocity, with elite movement, and we're asking these umpires to make a split-second call without the box there. They don't have it. We have it upstairs. You know, I have my TV upstairs set to be 5 seconds behind the live play. Why? So I watch it, I second-guess them like crazy, and I look to see if I'm right on the box or they're right. Now, I'm normally right, even though I'm hundreds of feet above the strike zone. I've got the umpire blocking me. I'm still always right. But I have the box. What we're asking them to do is very difficult. So as the technology continues to improve, I think it's going to be a serious debate. Yes, sir.
Okay, good news is this is literally a yes-no question. In your 10 years with the Pirates, has the franchise done any research into what they might have been doing or failing to do that other franchises were doing that the Pirates have never developed a top-flight starting pitcher that stayed with them for any length of time?
Yes.
Good.
Next.
Hi. Given that...
If you haven't noticed, let me just... say something. If you haven't noticed yet, and I hope you all come out to PNC Park, you will notice, we have very passionate fans here in Pittsburgh. Yes, sir.
Well, the Cubs can't develop starting pitchers either, so don't feel too bad. But given that modern nutrition and health and training are giving us more and more 6'5" pitchers who can throw 98 miles an hour, and that they're just physical limitations on what batters can do, doesn't it seem inevitable that the three true outcomes is going to be here to stay or expanding unless we do something like, you know, tampering with the ball?
There are a lot of issues with the ball. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if the answer is yes, but, and I won't mention his name, but a former major league player who was in our last competition committee thought the answer was to your question was yes, and now that he's out of the game, I'm sure he wouldn't have proposed this when he was in the game. He actually said, I think we need to move the mound back. That's revolutionary. But a former major league pitcher just recently off the field thought we needed to move the mound back to give the hitters a better chance. Yes, sir.
What's your opinion on, as a traditionalist, on the possibility of a change limiting mid-inning pitching changes, a rule change, which slow the game down and reduce offense?
So of all of the fundamental changes to the game that I've heard proposed, that one does not offend me. And of all those that I've heard to date, that one seems like it's getting the most legs.
Oh, God.
Yes, sir.
Has any thought ever been given to restricting replay on decisions to plays that directly involve scoring? For example, has there ever been an analysis done of how many times a player is declared out or safe at first, and they go through the whole replay process only to and that the guy spends the rest of the inning on first and doesn't go anywhere? I mean, do you know what?
Yes, I know exactly what you mean. No, I don't believe that we've looked at that way. I mean, it does change the game, even, and so I think it's impossible to say that it didn't affect the game if you reverse a call of out, say, and say it was safe. Even if he doesn't, if that runner doesn't score, it may extend the inning for 5 pitches, or it may extend the inning for 30 pitches, and still nobody scores. It has affected the game. So no, I don't think the replay that has been studied that way. We have looked at ways to reduce the number of replays that are allowed. Increased to now the 8th inning, so there's, you know, obviously one replay available, one challenge available, and if you're wrong, you lose your challenge and you can't challenge another one. That actually came back to bite us in Chicago. Mm-hmm. The last time we were there, I think we could have overturned a call. We had used our replay. We didn't have it. It wasn't the 8th inning yet. Used to be you could go to the crew chief for a crew chief challenge in the 7th. We moved that back to the 8th. We've also talked about potentially moving it back to the 9th, making that challenge less likely to be made unless you're sure you're going to overturn it. I think if you did it only on scoring plays, we'd be back to frustrating my wife again, and I don't want to do that. Yes, sir.
How many minutes are devoted to commercials for each half inning, and would you consider cutting that in half and doubling the price?
Cutting it. Well, if we could double the price, trust me, we'd be doubling the price right now without cutting them down.
but you would be able to.
Yeah, so I don't think we're going to cut them in half. We have taken it down to 2 minutes and 15 seconds, and that's by reducing everybody to 2 minutes and 15 seconds between breaks. We have taken a minute out of the game. Could it go even further? Possibly. We've experimented with some commercials during the postseason where you have a commercial box mm-hmm. while you're still showing what's happening at the stadium. That's possible as well. So I think there could be more work to be done. I don't think we're going to reduce it between 2 minutes and 15 seconds by half. All right. Yes, sir.
Sir, I am a representative of a 19th century vintage baseball league that plays 60 games a season since 1994. We are on Long Island, where, like I said, the Atlantic baseball team. We played in major league venues and also minor league and also regular venues. Each year we play about 60 games. We are the best in the United States, okay? Some of these guys have played with me since 1994. I want to ask you a question. Is there any chance that you would host us by doing nothing, just letting us play, and you can pick the team you want, and we would give you anybody, and we would also educate the audience about it, and we are insured, by the way.
Hmm. That's important. Why don't you grab me when I get off here, okay?
I'll have plenty of cards.
All right.
And our expression is no gloves, no steroids.
Outstanding. Well, thank you. Yes, I've been told it's the last one.
Oh. Tony Menendez from the Saver, Puerto Rico. First of all, from all the people from Puerto Rico, thank you. Gracias.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony.
One of the declines of Puerto Rican baseball players into baseball from minor leagues to majors is the MLB draft. Everybody now knows that we are U.S. citizens and we go through that MLB draft. What is the possibility to go back to the international draft? What is your opinion yourself? And second, when we will have the Pirates back in San Juan?
We'd love to be there sooner rather than later. So please ask Mr. Manfred to get the Pirates back there. I know there are two teams coming next year. It's not the Pirates. We wish we were part of that. We were supposed to go, and we had the whole Zika player concern, which I get. The Puerto Rican players going into the draft, along with players from Canada, it makes no sense, people. I mean, every other American sport, football, which doesn't have a lot of global players playing the game, basketball, that does have a lot of players globally playing the game in the United States at the highest level, and hockey, which is very much like us. There are players in the NHL from all over the globe. They all come into the league under the same set of rules, a draft. In baseball, we discriminate against kids from the United States, including Puerto Rico, and kids from Canada. If you think the draft is more onerous than the aggregate international signing bonus pool. I'm not sure now. Given back when it used to be, if you're from anywhere other than the United States, including the territory of Puerto Rico and Canada, you are a free agent. You can sign for the highest dollar available. These other players can only sign with one team in a draft. That, to me, made no sense. I've been a proponent of one set of rules for all players for many years. My position has not won the day. I don't think it's nearly as advantageous to be thrown into the pool of international players now, because there is now a very hard cap on what you can spend internationally. So it's different. I don't think the Puerto Rican players are going into that rule. Do we ever get to a point where we have everybody under the same rules? I hope so, but I've hoped so for a while. Thank you. I'm getting pulled off the stage. You've been very kind. Have a great set of meetings and enjoy Pittsburgh.